Welcome to the Agile Wire, brought to you by Wisconsin Agility. We want you to get agile and stay agile. Now here are your hosts, Jeff Bubbles and Chad Beyer.
And we're recording. All right, kick us off, Jeff.
All right, we have Tommy Norman joining us on the podcast today. Tommy, you brought up an interesting topic as we were chatting just a little while ago. How do companies keep their soul as they grow?
Yes.
What are your thoughts? Like, what is the soul have of a company, and right. why does it deteriorate as they grow? Like, I think we can all probably relate to this, but like, tell me a little bit more about this question right. and why you brought it up.
And I probably stated it in a very over-dramaculous way, but it's not. I mean, you know, it's so, you know, I've been doing this for about 32 years, and I've been, you know, for a long time, I would go to big companies. You know, I have five kids. I'm a slow and steady wins the race. I was going to go in the big company that had all this stability. And of course, those big companies closed down offices and stuff like that, just like anybody else. I was a contractor for a long time, and I would be at a lot of startups and see some crazy stuff happen in them. But at least I was from the cheap seats, because I'm like, I get to go back to wherever I'm going. But then in the last 10 years, I've worked at a couple of smaller companies that have grown and been successful. I got introduced to this model. It's called The Climb. It's from these guys at Zora, and they're from Salesforce. And they talk about when a company grows, it goes through these focuses or these growth stages. Like when you have no money and you have an idea, your first thing is to prove the idea. I just have to get my idea out there. And that's when you're a scrappy startup and you're building a scrappy prototype or whatever it is. Once that gets traction, then you go into the prove the product. Now I have to kind of pay back all that technical debt. I have to build a product that I can expand and build things onto. You prove your market. You know, I sold to a handful of people. They seem to like it, but is that a deep market? Do I need to shift markets? What do I need to do? And when you're all through that, when you kind of are, you know, really a real boy in Pinocchio sense, you then have to scale and you have to prove your business. And I have found that that is a very critical time of when a company, you know, you change at every one of those inflection points, but I've seen the most change at that point in time. And it's not that it's bad or good, but a lot of times that change can change the core of what the company is. You know, and I've been through several of these and they were successful. So I worked at a little startup product company, and the people who started it were very clear that we want to sell this and make lots of money. And we're like, okay. And then when they got somebody that was interested in it, they got to the prove the business part and they found somebody who was interested in it. That company, you know, there was a lot of overlap. So there was like, I was in the agile coaching wing and they said, we don't do agile coaching. And in fact, our agile coaches are the people we partner with to sell. We don't want to conflict with them. So they let go of all the agile coaches. That's a smart decision. I mean, I didn't like it because I was part of that, but I got it. But then they did, you know, they said, we're not going to do any more layoffs. And then about 3 months later, they did some more layoffs. And about 3 months later, they did some more layoffs. And, you know, if you cut off your hand to save your arm, that is a medical procedure. But if you keep cutting, that's torture. And so they sold that company and they made lots of money. And some of them went and started new companies. Some of them bought boats and sailed around Mediterranean. And this big company bought it and it kind of became something different. I still think the product is great and stuff like that, but it just became something different. And it was kind of a, you know, from somebody who was there when we were small and we were a scrappy startup and everybody was passionate about it, to see it become this kind of mechanical thing made me lament that. But again, it is a successful company. It exited successfully. And I've seen that repeat multiple times. Again, sometimes being involved in it, sometimes being a victim of it, sometimes watching it from the outside. And after seeing it a couple of times and having it affect me that way, I started thinking, all right, is there a way that when you get to that point that you could still maintain? And when I say soul, you know, the values of why you started the company. So a lot of companies get started, you know, there's somebody passionate about something. You know, I'm passionate about this. And I'm starting a company now about this. And they usually attract people who are passionate about that. And so you start there and you go through all those phases. And when you then need to start being a real company, that's a lot of times when founders leave, because that's when you have to be in HR meetings and budget meetings. You're like, well, I don't like this. You know, you're not starting anything new anymore. And so they usually exit, and that's okay. And so probably sometimes a good idea. But then you bring in new people. And those new people you bring in aren't normally passionate about the thing you're building. They're passionate about sales. They're passionate about operations. They're passionate about, you know, this finance. And with good intentions, they still bring all the things from these other places. And it can almost be like death by, you know, death by a thousand cuts or the frog boiling. Either use either analogy you think. And you suddenly start going, you know, this doesn't feel like it did before. And you have to sometimes, I know I've had to sit there and go, is this still the place for me? Do I stay here and fight for that soul? Or is that actually bad? Like, is trying to maintain what we were before halting growth because we're now going from this little boutique passionate, you know, craftsman shop to a bigger thing, which is not necessarily bad. It's just different. So that's where that's come from. And that it's, you know, in the last 10 years been a little bit more personal to me, but I've seen it for years.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's multiple facets. I guess I'm thinking of some of my own personal experiences and companies that were smaller and they grew and the culture changed, right? Like even, let's just say you go from, you know, 50 people to 100 people and it changes and you're just like, and the people that have been that first 50, they tend to get, many of them get jaded, right? Like, it's not the same thing. This isn't the good old days. But the people that were in that 100 are like, this is great. And as you get to the next level, they're like, wait, that when we were like 100, that was great. And now the people at 200 are like, this is great, you know? And so I think everybody's experience is different. And maybe people just miss that culture. They miss what was there. And some of that you have to let go because it's like there's bigger things or maybe we're not aligned on where we're going. And sometimes people just aren't thoughtful too. I think that's another aspect. Like when you hire people, are you being thoughtful about the values they're living, what you're going to tolerate, and can you scale this? Because you can't communicate at the same level, the same way that you used to. I had a client recently and they were just talking about, well, you know, we used to just be able to have conversations, the four of us, and then things would propagate down and all the teams would know, it was only a few teams, and now we got all these teams and we can't do it that way anymore. And they struggle with like, we got to say something multiple times and we got to like put it in different types of mediums and we've got like, I want to just move fast like we used to. And it's like, you can't, you're trying to get a lot of people on the, going in the same direction. And so that can be a difficult thing, I think, for a lot of organizations.
Right. And at every one of those phases, when you kind of do these switchbacks, when you go from proving the idea to proving the market, you know, you become a different company. And the things that worked at one of those places to get you to that point don't work anymore. And so it is, like I'm with you in that. There's definitely times where I'm like, this is a good thing in certain ways, but I have definitely been the person who laments it. You know, I had a friend of mine, he was a serial startup guy. He loved going to startups. But he said, once the free Cokes go away, I'm out. Because he knows that is the canary in the coal mine if things are changing. And because he loved that startup part and he didn't like the now we're a business part. And that was just him, you know. And I've been at so many places where I watched, you know, CEOs or other executives bow out at certain times. And at the time, you know, when I was younger, I didn't understand it. I was like, why would you leave? You almost felt like you're getting abandoned. Like you've started this company. Why? But I get it now. I'm like, you know, now the stuff that's coming in that needs to be done requires a different skill set. And I think it's actually very mature of someone to go, I don't have that skill set, or I'm not good at that, or that's not my passion. Let me clear the way for somebody who can take this to that next level. And that next level may look like something different. And I do wonder, you know, is there a way? Can those two things happen? You know, and you maintain a lot of that.
I'm still hopeful.
That's the thing.
I'm hopeful that it's possible to scale a company without selling your soul. And, you know, so for those who are listening and not watching the video version, Tommy, like many guests, I love this. Like I love it when guests have guitars hanging on their wall in the background because then I can start using analogies and talking about music. So I think about a band, right? I just was watching, I think it was a video with Butch Vig, and he was talking about recording the Smashing Pumpkins first album, I believe. And they were, it's just all those bands in the 90s, or name your era, right? There's that point where they make the decision, are we going to sell out? And I feel like this was especially in the 90s, right? Like, are you going to sell out now? And are you going to become the big, you know, the big corporation, the big thing that now you've got a publicist, now you've got a tour manager? And to me, the analogy, the connection here is like you're giving up more and more control the more people you involve in things that are not core to it, right? So like,
right.
And is it possible? Can a band that doesn't want to sell out ever get that big? I think it's possible at the org level. I think we're seeing this with even stand-up comedians these days. It used to be that you needed to get onto Leno, Letterman, or one of the big late-night shows, or Johnny Carson was the original, right? And there were only so many broadcast networks that kind of were the phase gate to that.
Right.
But now, comedians have changed the paradigm. They run their own podcast, of course, through a platform like YouTube, so they have some control. They don't have 100% control, but way more control than they used to. And now that's what sells seats to their shows, and they have way less people involved, and so they can scale, but not so much sell out, right? So
right.
I don't know. I think it's possible for an organization to not sell out. I think we have a lot of we have a lot of structure in literature like Reinventing Organizations by Frederick Laloux that talk about this. I think there's ways to scale up and bring more people in without completely selling out. That's a good talk title right there, huh?
There you go.
Scale up without selling out.
So I'm from Nashville, the Music City. And there's a term they use here called losing the dudes. And it's when you reach that point where you're the small little band, and you have these rabid fans. And then the fans start showing up that were there from you to the beginning. And then all the casual fans who know your one song off the radio show up and only sit for that one song and then leave. And all those fans are like me, you know, the one like, I remember when, you know, da da da. And you lose the dudes. But in losing the dudes, you gain this whole new thing. And it is. Yeah. It's a music industry, because that's what, you know, Nashville is a music industry town. And there's the business side of it, and there's the art side of it. And not that, you know, well, I would take that back. You know, a lot of, you know, software people believe that this is art, but it's still a thing that gets us to the thing. You know, yes, you get paid to code, but that's not what the thing is. The thing is whatever I'm building. Either I'm building a product,
you're
I'm
solving.
All right. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and this is definitely a little bit of old man yells at clouds, you know, but it is a thing that I thought about. And now when I'm looking at, you know, next opportunities, I'm also thinking about how do I, you know, so one of the things is like knowing, so that growth model with a climb, it layers on top of a whole bunch of other models. There's Griner's growth model, there's Startup Genomes, you know, model that shows what phases people have gone through. Even the Agile Maturity model kind of sits on top of it that you see focuses at different levels. And so one thing I try to do is I try to figure out where this company is. Where are you at this? You know, a little you are here map. So I can know, all right, if you're here, then these are the problems you're having. In Griner's growth model, they call it crisis. You have a crisis of red tape. You have a crisis of leadership. You have a crisis of autonomy and these different things at different phases. And they match up pretty well. It's not black and white, but I've been through it enough where I'm like, yeah, I recognize those patterns over and over again. Because, you know, if I was hired by a startup that's at prove the idea, you know, like we have to ruthlessly prioritize things. We have to get things out. We're probably going to have to take on a ton of technical debt. We need to, you know, be smart about it, deliberate about it, but you're going to have to, because if you sit around with angel investment money trying to build the best thing, you're going to run out very quickly. Mm-hmm. But then once I'm done with that and I have to build a product, that's where I was at this product company. You know, they had been this scrappy little 15-member team in somebody's garage building this thing. And then they needed to turn quickly and get to build a product. And they brought in a whole new architecture team. And there was this huge war between the old school and the new school because they were going to new architecture. And these new people come in would just talk so bad about the old architecture. Oh, the ball of mud and da-da-da. And I'm like, that enabled us to hire you. You know, that got us. And there was reasons that those decisions were made. This is a company that was brand new in their space. And it was like, I remember before I got hired, I would say, man, I wish your product did this. And like 2 weeks later, it did that. And that's how they gained market share. That's how they got these people is being reactive to the market. But they did that at the sacrifice of long-term product health. And then they had to pay that back. And it's just, you know, I think all those things are okay if you're very deliberate. And then if you know these phases you're going through, you can kind of be prepared of saying, all right, I know this is going to happen. I know we're going to go through these crises. I know these are the things that normally in this phase that happen. I'm going to educate everyone around me about it so we're not surprised. Because that's another thing is that we always, like, we'd go to another startup and I would see, you know, as a contractor, sometimes people are always going, what do you mean after a year they bought us, they change us? I'm like, dude, that's what they say. Yeah, when you get bought by a big company, they said, we're never going to change you. That lasts a year at most. And just be ready for it. You know, I think if you're ready for it, I think some people come in and are naive and think this is always going to be this way. And I'm like, no, that's not a growth mindset. It has to change. You know, and even for me, when I'm complaining about, oh, I don't like how things are changing, and I'm supposed to be a change guy. You know, as an agile person, I'm supposed to be embracing change. But there are times where I'm like, I kind of liked what we did before.
This might be fun. What if I like the rule of three. Like, three things are typically easier to remember than anything else, right? So if we were to try to give listeners three things where they're less negotiable. Maybe there's a little right. give, but like, you know, as you scale up, you're going to make a lot of trade-offs, right? It's inevitable, right? But what are three things? What if we try to build three things that we're not? Like, if you do this, we believe you're going to maintain most of your soul as you scale up.
One of the big ones for me, because I saw this so many times when I personally experienced and witnessed from afar, is be very honest with yourself about when your values of your company change. Because a lot of people say, no, our values are still the same. And I'm like, no, they're not. I'm seeing you act in a way that doesn't speak to the way you used to. And it's okay. But to your point, Chad, to kind of go with that, you know, the business of music, like, no artist goes, yeah, I'm completely selling out because I want money. I want Garth Brooks money and I don't care. You know, nobody says that. They're like, no, I'm still the same artist. I'm like, no, you're not. You know, Green Day, you have millions of dollars. Your angsty teen thing is not working anymore. Just admit it and embrace that next phase. I've been at so many places where they said, you know, people are our foundation and this is our foundation. This is that. And I'm like, but then you're laying people off in a way that's not great. You're treating people in a way, you're putting people, you know, there's a lot of places I went where you were passionate about it because we left places that were like, I don't like that type of work and I want to go here and we're going to do the type of work we want to. And then what happens is, you know, to grow, you might have to take on some of that old type of work. And that may feel weird because like, I came here to get away from that work. And, you know, trying to say, well, no, we're still the same people. I'm like, no, we're not. We're different. Let's make sure our business goals and our values are very clearly outlined and mapped to each other.
So summarize for clarity to see if I'm hearing it correctly. Maybe something along the lines of be honest about the gap between your core values and your aspirational values. And I think I'm stealing from Lencioni, I think.
Probably.
I think he writes about that in The Advantage.
Right.
The core values versus aspirational. And if you're transparent and honest about that, now we all know that we're accepting the fact that it's okay to have values that we know are not living and breathing right now, but that's why you have them to move towards them. So something around honesty about the gap between values core one, and aspirational.
I would add in with the values one, you know, your culture is what you tolerate. We've said that, you know, multiple times in the podcast. So you really have to like not tolerate not living those values. Otherwise, you have new values and everybody brings whatever they bring from different organizations and they live those things. And then your culture is what those people bring. But I would go for number two then. I think maintaining your customer centricity and your problem centricity. What problem are you trying to solve? Because when you're a startup and you're a small company, you have no choice but to like focus on the problem and the customers. Like everybody's after whatever that thing is. And you just have to rally around the problem of the day. And so if you can maintain that instead of trying to focus on efficiency, I think that's what a lot of big companies get into. Like, well, we got to do a really good job of architecture. We got to do a really good job at databases, you know, and data or whatever. And it's like they forget why they're doing these things.
Right.
And then when people are just doing the skill without a connection to the customer or the problem, I think that's when your culture definitely makes a big shift.
Well, and your people. I mean, you know, all of this, you know, the people is still part. And Chad, maybe a good second one is, you know, so there's aspirational values, there's the values you have now, and there's the values you used to have that you kind of have to, you know, what is it, Marie Kondo? You know, does this spark joy anymore? No, thank it and let it go. You know, this is not what we need anymore.
Yeah.
You know, being honest about that. And then I think the second thing would be is then also be very clear about your business goals. And this is separate from like problem solving for the customer. So like I've been at places where we want to sell in 5 years. Okay, I'm not going to play long ball then. You know, there's investments that I would make in this, you know, in a situation where we're like, I want to retire from this company and this company's going to last forever. But if you're wanting to sell in a couple of years, there's different things I would invest in and not invest in. And so being very clear about business milestones. So like I told you, as I'm interviewing in companies now, I will sit down and say, what are your business goals the next 3 months, 6 months, a year, 5 years, and 10 years? You know, so that I can understand what I should be really working on and working towards. And when I worked as a consultant, that was a big thing for us because sometimes a company would come to us and want us to build some software for them. And we would do that exercise and we would find out, all right, we're building all this customer stuff, but really you are a connector. You connect, you know, this provider and this provider, and that's what gives the customer their value. And you have to have all those providers first, or you don't have anything to sell to your customer. So let's build all the provider stuff first, because you're about to go to this big conference that you can show them, get them signed up as integrators, and then you'll have a bunch of stuff to sell. And that changes like that. You know, if I had just come in blind and not really asked that, we probably would have been, you know, to your point, Jeff, very customer centric, solve customer problems. But that's not the first problem we had to solve. Or some people come in and say, I just need to rewrite from an old technology to this technology, and I just need parity.
Right.
Okay. You know, that's fine. And as long as we really know why we're doing it, you know, it has to have some business value. If it doesn't make dollars, it doesn't make sense. And there's four reasons you do anything in a business: increase revenue, protect revenue, avoid cost, or decrease costs. If I don't know how it maps to one of those, why am I doing it? You know,
yeah, I like
am I
that.
Just shooting in the dark?
So like Simon Sinek, right? Start with why. Maybe this is like, never stop talking about why, or live and breathe the why.
Right.
Because like, again, the pressure is we're going to scale up. We're going to become the big boy company now. So now everybody's, you know, we got to have a big department and we have to have layers of management. And what that does is separate the people doing the work who you need to exist. They miss out on the true why, because a lot of that information, those business objectives you're talking about, are shielded from everyone. And so we have glimpses of the why, but they're at such a granular level that we can't see what all the people in the strategy room are talking about. So I think the advice here is something along the lines of like clarity throughout the organization on the why. I like
and,
it.
Yeah,
I love
making
it.
Sure you don't have
I
want to
work
thinking.
For this company. So far, I still want to work for this company. So I think we're doing pretty well here.
But to your point, Chad, there's this idea of magical thinking. And when I moved into the executive suite, like we would have a meeting and we'd go, yeah, it's a great idea. And we'd put it out on Slack or put it out of this and da-da-da. We're like, yeah. And then a month later, when it's all going to hell, we're like, why is this? And we're like, it's magical thinking. We think, just because we think it and we live and breathe it because we're in these strategy meetings and all this stuff, it's tactically not water getting down. It's not getting down there. And then to your point, and maybe this is number three, I don't know. Let me give you some anecdotes. When you bring in those new people who are now not passionate about the reason of that, and you could try to get people who are aligned, but you're hiring a chief of sales, a chief of marketing, a chief financial officer, a chief operations officer. They are passionate about those things. And I saw, I'll give you an example. So I worked at a company that work-life balance was very, very, very critical to them, to the point of where we had a client demand that people work nights and weekends. And I sat down with our executive team and we said, we're not going to do that. It will be voluntary. If the team wants to do it, it'll be voluntary. And I said, all right, I'm going to have to go to this hard-nosed client. And if they still demand it, can I walk out? And they're like, absolutely. And that is, to me, that's showing your integrity. You know, integrity is doing the right thing, even though it hurts. And this was a big client, and losing it would have hurt, and it would have, you know, but like, listen, this will burn our people out. Dah, dah. So we made that decision. And the client was fine with it and it all worked out great. And we had that client for years. Bring in all these new people. And I was working with a sales organization. And you had people who would say, oh, I saw, you know, like we had a bunch of new salespeople who were just doing cold calls, stuff like that, BDRs type stuff. I saw so-and-so online making calls at 6 o'clock on a Friday night. Good job. And I'm like, oh, no. You know, don't say that out loud in a meeting. Don't encourage that. That is not what we're about. And there was more and more and more of that. And I got worried. I'm like, okay, yo, this is a senior part of leadership exhibiting a behavior and encouraging behavior that we used to discourage. I need those. Somebody needs to resolve that. You either tell me that's what you want now and I'll be okay. You know, I don't necessarily like that, but I get it. I've worked that way before. We've all done it. But we used to be willing to, you know, take a little bit on the chin because of this. And, you know, now you could, you know, like a operations or a finance person might say, well, that's ridiculous. That's, you know, that's financially irresponsible of you to do that. And I'm like, well, maybe it is. I don't know, you know. So how do you...
I think that one maybe aligns back to our values, right? Behavior should align to values, right? Like that's, I think in any company, I don't care what size you are, you could be any stage, like that should be something that you do.
Right? So that's still a lack of values. That's a good point. So we have values, we have the why and the business reasons.
Yep. Yeah. And I think with that one, I would add on like kind of part of like, you know, the behaviors or the values, like you also need some level of autonomy. Like if I have problems or I have customer problems, I have business problems, whatever it might be, and I'm trying to solve them, I think what also kills companies as they grow, it's like now I got to go and I got to meet for 3 months to talk about this idea. Now it's not a problem anymore. Or like somebody else solved it. Like I just want to be able to do stuff. That can be really disengaging as a person on those teams where it's like you just can't solve the problems that are in front of you because you have to get so many approvals or whatever might be stopping you inside of your organization.
Yeah, and I've seen that where, you know, and I, again, being part of a small startup on a small executive team, you did everything. And I would be in meetings like I'm in some HR meeting that I don't feel qualified to be. Why am I in this meeting? I should not be in this meeting, but you're it. Like you're the only people there. And so then you start hiring people that are, again, specialized in those things, but it gets away from you. It's now, and so then you get to the point, I used to, I remember being at one startup where they talked about like a little balloon. And if you take these little dots and you draw them on a little balloon and these dots are very close and then I blow up the balloon, they get further and further away. And so the people that you used to be really connected to, and then people get put in between you. So, you know, when we're small, I'm in marketing meetings. Am I a marketing person? No, but I do a lot of thought leadership, stuff like that. So I was in a lot of marketing meetings. Then we hire a director of marketing who's now making all those decisions. And, you know, you have to reconcile with yourself to kind of let that stuff go, but also still, you know, hopefully you, when you hired that person, again, you made sure they align with your values. They understand what your needs are, but then you also kind of have to let that go and understand that now there's a layer between you and something that you used to do before. And to your point, Jeff, you know, when you start having that, it just, the connection points are now multiplied and exponential. And it's like barnacles on the bottom of a boat. They just grow and your boat just gets slower and slower and slower. Mm-hmm. And so how do you keep that nimbleness in there? And I don't know.
I don't know.
Yeah, I know.
I guess what I've seen work well, and I'll let you jump in here, Chad, is more of a network. So like whenever you can have smaller groups of people working together, because you need to know the people you're working with. I think that's another, you know, people want to be known. They want to like have relationships. They want to think they want their work to matter, right? They want to get good at things. And so I think you do like having this like almost like small companies instead of a bigger company or like molecules that split. Like if you have that concept, but we work together, we just have to figure out how, what those interfaces look like when we work together. A model like that, we've seen that work pretty well. But it's not easy to do. And you have all these other problems with the product and your scaling and whatever else. And like people are just like, oh, we've always done a hierarchy. Just do the hierarchy thing, specialize by, you know, departments. And, you know, we're going to go down this route. And that's the easy route. But it also can be the thing that really slows you down to your point. Like it can add a lot of those barnacles that just the thing that made you successful in the past won't be that thing anymore. So now you're going to have to find a new way to be successful.
Yeah, I got recommended recently a new podcast. Well, it's not a new podcast. It's been around forever, but new to me. Now I'm going to look at my phone. This is totally not professional, but I don't remember the name of it. Brave New Work, and it's by a company called The Ready. And you know, it's not necessarily agile per se, but it's got a lot of those things of modern agile stuff. Yeah. But the first one I listened to kind of put me off at first. I still really like it. I am recommending it. But the first one put me off because a lot of companies I went, when we went into these from kind of the small little catch as catch can, figuring things out to bigger companies. We adopted some of these, one of these enterprise or corporate OS systems that are now popular. Of you do these, and it's almost like Scrum. Here's the meetings you have, here's the artifacts you have, here's the da 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 da. And if you do this, you will be successful. And I'm like, no, that's not true. And I would be in these meetings, and we, you know, when you usually have a software that goes with it, now you run all your meetings with the software, and you do this at this point in time, it lasts this many minutes, you do this. And then I would watch things like, I'd be talking to someone and say, well, we need to bring that up in this blah, blah, blah meeting. And they go, nothing's going to happen. I'm either going to get yelled at or nothing's going to happen. I'm like, all right, then we're missing the core point of this, which is trust. You know, that goes back to the Lencioni, mm-hmm. the dysfunctions of a team. If we don't trust each other, all this prescriptive process and operating system stuff doesn't matter at all. And if you feel like I can't think, it doesn't matter how well-structured that meeting is and well-intended it is, if I don't feel like my voice is being heard, if I don't feel like I can bring it up, and I've worked so many places where that's happened, where I personally did it, where I went in saying, I really want to say this, but I know if I say this, it's just going to cause more problems than it's worth. And that's not an organization you want to be in.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. And does that happen because of misaligned values? Does it happen because now you're abstracted from people? You know, does the blind adherence to a prescriptive process that's going to magically fix things exacerbate it? You know, I don't know. It's a lot of little tuning of knobs that, you know, I don't think one of them is the one that actually, you know, tips things over.
Yeah, it feels like the related topics of, so they feel like desired states, right? Like we started this with Jeff, you threw out autonomy. So freedom, autonomy, psychological safety, ownership right. mentality. I'm going to ask the question, maybe we can reverse engineer this. You know, act like an owner, ownership mentality. Why don't people act that way? And I think it comes back to, we could call it trust, sure. We could call it lack of transparency of what's going on. We already talked about those two, you know, the two items somewhat in the, you know, explain the why, where we're going. But I think also there is that piece of just, you are not, anytime somebody doesn't act in those moments, it's probably fear of something. Right. Yeah. And I don't know, maybe psychological safety is the best phrase for that. But like you would fear something, retaliation. What kind of retaliation? At the end of the day, we're all optimizing to protect our households. So in a way, you fear that loss of being part of this organization, this entity. Right. So what is the secret sauce? What's the third item to ensure that is amplified in the opposite direction? I think it is. You know, you can't just write empowerment on a wall and say, we value empowerment. And then everyone's like, great. And I will suggest everything I think of now without fear of retaliation. That's not how it works. I think the only way someone really gets comfortable that way is truly having real decision-making authority. And sure. I think the stories of the organization and all the literature we could mention today, they have had that, right? There's this story of like, the frontline worker made a critical decision on behalf of the organization and no one said, why did you do that? Or you shouldn't have done that. You should have checked with us first. So I think if you're going to scale up and keep your soul, back to our opening statement, I feel like you've got to really live and breathe that decision-making authority in some context, right? There's a book called The Decision Maker by Dennis Bakke. I read that one over a decade ago, I feel like now, and man, that it had an impact on me because it talks about decisions. Like just if you break down an organization and you scale up, the more people you involve, the more micro decisions are going to have to happen throughout any given moment. And if you're not cognizantly thinking about how those decisions are made, you inevitably will become probably like the Titanic.
Right.
Hey, we need to make a decision and it's extremely slow, right? Maybe that's not a great example, but I'm thinking of like turning a large ship around, right?
Sure.
It's right. Not the sailboat. In a sailboat, I have maybe me and one other person and we're making the decision on whether we want to go left or right. But when you're in a big ship, there's a lot of working components that have to go into turning the ship around or changing course, so...
Well, and I love that you bring up fear. Yeah, that's something I bring up in almost anything I talk about. I'm like, listen, at the end of the day, we are still barely evolved. and we're still, you know, just, you know, afraid and throwing our crap at each other. Yeah, you know, at the core of what's going on. And when we act out of fear, anything, a decision made mostly out of fear is usually a bad decision. And you're right. You know, there, you know, I've been at companies where I'm like, I'm afraid to say this because of, yeah, to your point, retaliation. I may, you know, lose political capital or decision influence. I may not get this gig. I may lose this client. I may that. And when I'm surrounded by an organization that's like, yeah, you shouldn't do that, that's bad, you know, that then just compounds it, you know. And to your point, I then don't feel safe. And so I will resort to tried and true things, you know, and what I think is tried and true, I put that in quotes because they're not, they're just it's the stuff I did before. It's probably just as bad as what I was going to do, but I can rely on it and say, and defend myself later and say, well, that's just always how we've done it. Or,
yep,
you delay the inevitable. You know, I'm going to, you know, look busy, you know, and then, you know, at the last moment go, oh, by the way, that doesn't work. Or push things off so long that when it does come up, I'm so out of options that now I'm now, you know, constrained to this. And I think that's it's a very important thing because, as I said, when we had all these new operating systems and things like that, when I would hear people say, I'm afraid to bring that up. You know, yeah. I just don't. And I would go into meetings saying, I want to bring this up. And I would talk to another person. They're like, you should bring that up. And I'm like, I'm going to bring this up and this is going to happen. And then I go in and that would happen. And I would go, I just learned not to do that again. You know, yeah. And one of my, you know, it's a good quality or a bad quality, depending on which side of it you're on, is I'm a little Don Quixote at sometimes, you know.
Yes.
If I am passionate about something and I think it's a value of our company, it's worth defending, then I will lean in and charge that windmill. And yep, there's been times where like peers of mine who loved me would say, maybe a little less Tommy, maybe take it down a little bit. And I will try. And then I'll watch the train wreck go and I'll go, I can't not say it. And
yeah,
it's the squeaky wheel gets the grease, but every now and then the squeaky wheel gets replaced. And that's just, you know, I don't know. I'm over 50. I don't know if I'm going to really change that anytime soon.
It's so awesome, Tommy. I'm so glad you brought up the Don Quixote. So I we can riff on this. When I was early on in my career, right, I didn't know what I didn't know. And I started joining these Fortune 500 organizations. And it was like everyone, it's not like they were numb, but they all acted funny to me. And I didn't understand it at the time. I came in tilting at every windmill, right? Like I was just back to the Don Quixote story. Like if there was a battle to fight for change, I was fighting it. And it was like there was a large elephant in the room. And I joined the company and I'm like, what are we going to do about this elephant? And everyone's like, don't talk about that elephant. Or, hey, you'll young Padawan, you'll learn how to
slow down
how
there,
things,
cowboy.
Yeah, they'd always be like, you'll figure out how things work around here. We don't talk about that elephant. And I was like, what are you guys talking about? I was just like floored. I was like, we're going to talk about that elephant. I'm going to talk about that elephant right now. I'm going to talk about it tomorrow and the next day. And so I got the same reputation of the Don Quixote reference. Don't tilt at that windmill. Pick your battles. I had a manager. Yep. I'm not going to mention his name.
Shop.
I think I've mentioned his name on too many podcasts, but he knows. If he's listening, he knows. He would always tell me, pick your battles. And I was probably so hard for him to manage. And I would say, no, I'm going to pick all of them. Like, I'm going to fight every battle. Because it was like a divide by zero error for me to like not want to change a status quo thing that was frustrating, stupid, didn't make any sense, right? So why not change it? And I think that those matter, right? Because like, yeah, did I win all the battles? No. But, you know, the fear of retaliation, I think I didn't fear it as much, maybe out of being young and naive, but it helped me challenge those things.
Right.
It's when that fear creeps in that you stop, you know, you stop challenging the status quo. And that's a sad part of an organization, right? Again, I think that's the soul. It's creeping away. It's fading away.
So if we go back to the fear, like why does the fear exist? And why do people why do they think, oh, I can't do this thing, or I'm going to get this, they're going to respond in this way. Usually, I think it comes down to information. So usually somebody has information in the organization that they're not sharing with somebody else. And so because they have the information, you bring it up, and then like a decision is made that you're like, I don't get this. And then you get frustrated, or you have fear because like they, you know, you get rejected because you didn't have that information and you should have known that for some reason, right? And then you lose that owner mentality. So I think these things are all kind of connected. But I think the hard part about like decision making that people like don't realize is like decision making, like it's not so much about the decision. The decision making is easy. The work is hard. And so like I'm thinking about this George Patton quote where he says, you know, a good plan violently executed today is better than a perfect plan, you know, next week. You know, and some, you know, leaders, they just like, we got to have the perfect plan. And if you're a startup company, you're a smaller company, like you're just going to execute and it's going to be a good plan, but you're going to violently execute it all together in one unit. And that's going to like help with all the change management and all this other stuff. And so maybe we have to be more okay with like not the perfect decision being made, but good decisions. And like, I think kind of does maybe come back to the autonomy a little bit, but like also the sharing of information as you grow. Like, I think that's important.
Well, it's like there's this joke about the young businessman sees this very older successful businessman and he goes, you know, sir, how did you become so successful? And he says, good decision, son, good decision. And he goes, how did you know how to make all those good decisions? And he goes, bad decision, son, bad decisions. You know, that's the way you grow. And when you get into a company that's afraid to make a bad decision, then you get that vapor lock and it becomes a cancer to everyone else. And so a thing that, you know, I'm also passionate about, we kind of talked about this offline, is, you know, building psychological safety through data. You know, I'm a big fan of metrics. And metrics, I don't, you know, like people say data driven, and somebody the other day said data influenced. I like that better. You know, metrics, you know, are metrics. The good thing about metrics is they don't care about your feeling. The bad thing about metrics is they don't care about your feelings. And feelings still matter. How, you know, we know all the data about Oreos. They are bad for us. But I will eat them. You know, you can't see. Luckily, we're only up. But you can't see down here that I know, like the data. There is tons of data. I know all the data about if I eat this, this is bad for me. And I'm going to feel bad. And I'm going to be like, I'm so fat. Why am I doing this? I know exactly why it is. We don't normally act in our best business until there's a story with that data. Yeah. So you have to have both of those things. But I like data to kind of guide you. I like data to give you, you know. So if I wanted to say, go do this, Jeff and Chad, I would want to express values and intent. Let me give you as wide a box as possible to play in. You can't go outside of this. Like, you can't just go crazy. But let me make that as wide as possible. And then there's some guidelines inside there that certain things, like, you know, maybe the financial officer going, like, you got to be careful about this. And the architecture people are going to say this, this, and this. But those can be, you know, poked around a little bit. And then there's going to be this wide space that there might be recommendations, but that's to take it or leave it. And what I want to see is small data-influenced curious experiments that we learn from. And if they're small and we use data to kind of say, all right, and this comes back to, if anybody's familiar with Toyota Kata, which is, you know, data-driven experimentation. So I have a challenge. We want to, you know, increase our market share by 25% in the next year. Okay, how are we going to do that? You know, here's where we are now. We have this many customers. Maybe if we build some more features in our mobile app, we might increase that. So, you know, then, you know, the near challenge becomes we want to build a mobile app. We want to build a couple of these new features and we get this out. Let's start experimenting with that. And so, you know, where are we now? What's a good step that would get us there that is something that's measurable in weeks or months instead of years? And let's do that. And we think about, all right, I want to increase this, but I don't want to decrease this. So maybe I want to get faster at delivery. So we're going to focus on speed, but I need to make sure quality doesn't get affected. Team happiness doesn't get affected. You know, client satisfaction doesn't get affected. So set up some guardrail metrics of this should increase, but these shouldn't change outside of these parameters. And then you do little small experiments and you come back and go, all right, what is our current condition based on our target condition, based on where we were before? This changed, you know, that changed. I didn't like that. Let's keep an eye on that. What's preventing us from the next step? What are your obstacles? And then let's do an experiment about that. And the most important part is after you do an experiment, we get together as a team and we go, what did we think would happen? What actually happened? What did we learn? And what are we going to take about that learning and incorporate in our next step? And if that's done well and it's built into the culture of the organization, you're giving people freedom. You're giving them that autonomy you talked about, but I'm also doing it in a way that I'm making it safe to fail. If you're doing experiments, experiments are going to fail. They're supposed to. You know, that's the, you know, you learn more from your failures usually than your successes. But I'm giving you a safe way to do that. And I'm giving it into you a way that making them small and by having guardrail metrics and things like that, I make it to where you can't really get too far. Or if you do one of those, we can course correct very easily. And I'm focusing on learning. And the good leaders I've had, I'll tell you another story. We were doing a big rollout. I was a big product company. We're doing this big rollout. And it had not been going well. And so me and another guy were about to run this big SQL script that was going to do all these changes and stuff. And we started it. And it was one of these ones that back in the old days took forever to run. It was going to take like an hour to run. So there was nothing to do. Like, you can't touch the system while it's doing this. So we went and played ping pong. We'd been there all day. It was late, you know. So we're playing ping pong. My boss comes in. Now, all my boss knows is the rollout's going to crap. And he comes in and sees me and this other guy playing ping pong. Now, a lot of guys would say, what the hell are you playing ping pong? What's going on? Or more mildly would have said, hey, where are we at? Da, da, da. He didn't do any of that. He leaned up against the wall. He made a lot of comments about how bad I played ping pong. And then he goes, what's going on? What can I do to help? You know, and we said, well, we're running the SQL script. It's going to take a while. Da, da. After that, we have to do this. He goes, you know, what can I do? Is there anything I can do? And we're like, no. And he goes, well, it sounds like you guys are going to be here late. And he's like, yeah. And he's like, all right, I'm going to go order food for everybody. What do you guys want? You know, he didn't come in yelling. He eventually got what he wanted. He did want to know, like inside, he wanted to know what the hell's going on. But he understood. He trusted us. We're smart guys. We wouldn't be in here willy nilly. You know, we're not, you know, Nero playing fiddle while Rome burns. And his first reaction was, what can I do to help you? And I loved that. And I got from Edwards Deming the idea that as a leader or a manager or an executive in the company, my job is to put enough process in place to allow you to do your best work in an environment where you feel safe and doing the right thing is easy. So if something happens and somebody does something that doesn't go well, my first instinct when I talked to him is to go, I'm sorry. I didn't make doing the right thing easy. I didn't give you a process that allowed you doing your best work. I'm part of this as well. So first of all, what could I do could have made that easier for you to have done the right thing or made the right thing more obvious to do instead of putting them on them.
Yep.
And organizations I've been where that is, there's curiosity. There is humility. There's ownership at all levels, recognizing that, you know, I'm steering, you know, I'm the captain of the ship. So it all goes up. You should be the first person as a leader when something like happens to go, all right, what did I do wrong? And you don't see enough of that. You see it all be, you know, oh, well, these guys don't know. They're not executing what I told them to do. You know, and it gets into all the things we just talked about. Do they know what they're doing? Do they know why they're doing it? You know, have you given them the space to do it? Maybe they're acting that way because you're such a tyrant. You know, how you consume bad news dictates how you're given bad news. And so nobody wants to give you bad news anymore. So I think that, you know, that is a huge part of this.
Awesome. I think we captured maybe at least two, I remember, right? We got something around values.
I think we got the three.
Yeah, we got something around, and now I'm blanking, something around values, something around, we just came from the conversation around decision-making, information,
the why,
fear, psychological
making
safety.
Sure,
oh, yeah, and
why.
Then sandwiched
and
in the middle,
drivers,
we had
the
why on the business objectives and drivers. So I think that's pretty good. I mean, it's hard to whittle this down to only three things. So, but enjoyed the conversation today. Tommy, is there anything else, you know, at risk of us geeking out for another hour and making this a 2-hour episode about music? I'll hold off, but is there anything in general that you want to plug or let anyone know about?
Well, we discussed before, I think by the time we're live with this, I'll have already been at the Scrum Gathering, but also I will be speaking at Agile 2023. I'm speaking on psychological safety and data at the Scrum Gathering at Agile 2023. I'm doing a deep dive just in metrics in general, but this will come up. You know, the way I approach metrics is before I start getting into these are metrics you should do. We talk about why metrics are important, and you know, metrics are about observing and influencing rather than setting and dictating, and dictating and enforcing, and try to you know. Even though I do talk a lot about metrics and building dashboards and, you know, trends and stuff like that, the whole first part is just the why you do this and how you approach this is even more important than the actual metric itself. Because you can tell, and I have instances where I take the exact same metric and say, here's one way to approach it in a way that is curious and promotes continuous improvement. And here's one way to approach this that shuts down everything and makes everybody afraid. But it's the exact same metric. It's just how it's approached. It's different. And it flows into everything we just talked about, because I think it's all about safety. But that's, you awesome. Know, that's coming up for me. And I've got some, I have one of those metrics talks is out on O'Reilly. So if you have O'Reilly Learning Online, I've got a whole bunch of stuff on O'Reilly. I'm about to do a release planning one for them later this year as well. So if you're subscribed to O'Reilly Online, or you can buy it all on Inform IT, I have a bunch of videos up there as well.
Awesome. Any music related stuff happening at the Agile conference this year?
No, you know, that was a special thing at when it was in Nashville and when I was at Acklin. And of course, Acklin, the CEO of Acklin was a drummer in the band. And oh, nice. So, you know, we did the opening night. It went great. It was so much fun. But trying to replicate that in another town, like fly band members down and stuff like that, probably not going to happen. Now, I'm up for a jam no matter what. As a side gig, I am the vice president of the Nashville Blues and Roots Alliance. And one of the things I do is we have a jam every night, if not multiple jams. And so every city I go to, I usually travel with my guitar and I try to find an open jam. I was at Austin Agile, you know, earlier this year and found a couple of jams and went and jammed down there. So if there's something in Orlando, let me know. I'm ready to play.
Yeah, just so background for the listeners, right? Last year at Agile, Tommy, you invited me, right, to come and maybe geek out and sing some of my Agile parody songs on stage with like a real band, which is my lifelong dream to be in a real band. I want to be in a real band someday. But anyway, background before that, when we first met, right, the way I met you, you were running the first Music City Agile conference, right? You'd always
probably
had the tech.
I think so.
You'd had the tech version of it in the past, I think, but that was the first Music City Agile in Nashville. And I was relatively new to public speaking at the time, and I wasn't quite as confident to get up on stage and sing into a microphone. But I was like, people were telling me I should do it, and I'd written this funny, you know, song called Tennessee Scrum.
I remember,
right? You know, Johnny Cash's Tennessee Stud, and of course, Johnny Cash Museum is, you know, I'm off Broadway in Nashville there, so I think I even went to it the last time I was in Nashville. Anyway, I remember I would think it was a phone conversation, maybe it was a Zoom call, I can't remember, but I was like, if I wanted to like get up on stage or at my session, if I wanted to sing a song, like, would it be like okay to do that? And then you were basically like, yeah. And I was like, all right. And I talked about how am I going to get a guitar there? And you're like, dude, this is Nashville. Music City. We of course will have a guitar here. So you're like, do it. And then on top of that, you even let me close the conference out on the main stage with my song right after I'd done my session. So you were like, whether you know it or not, you were very... you were like the very beginning of giving me that nudge and pushing me out of my comfort zone to do things. Jeff obviously was the second half of that because he's like, you should post these on YouTube. And now I'm, you know, doing more and more of it, right? But it was back to the fear thing, right? It was super scary when you're not 100% confident with your delivery of, you know, up on stage. So anyway, I want to thank, one, I'm glad that we met, our paths crossed on this planet, and thank you for the impact you had back, who knows when that was, 2015, 2016. I tell that story often to people, right? Like my actual first song ever was on stage at Music City Agile, all thanks to Tommy Norman. So
no, it was great. I loved it. And I love all the Agile ones coming, you know, that you put out. I'm super jealous of them. I'm like, oh, that was a great idea. Man, I wish I'd had that idea.
It's so much fun.
But it's fantastic. But yeah, one day we will get all that back together and you could, you know, we'll do the full band thing and you can have the whole band backing you with all these
great
songs.
That'd be great.
We'll
do a full-on mashup. Yeah.
Yep.
All right, cool. Well, thank you. And if there's anything you want us to leave in the show notes, let us know. We'll get that posted. Otherwise, thanks for the awesome conversation, and we'll probably chat with you again at some point in the future.
Absolutely. Thank you guys so much for having me. This was a great conversation.
If you found value in today's episode, share this with a friend. Until next time, get agile and stay agile.